Thanks, and thanks for so many of you coming. This has a background, these remarks, which is that for about 30 years, there's been social science work on human behavior that's produced at least one Nobel Prize, and a few others are to come. And for about 10 years, this work has had an effect within the law schools, maybe fewer, in the sense that people have been really fascinated in thinking about how human beings deviate from rational actor models. I should say, maybe when I was first teaching, there was the rational actor model, and then there was skepticism. And the skeptics didn't have an account, or anything like an account, by which to counter the rational actor types, which led to a certain frustration in the debate. But now there's an account that's emerged. What is just starting to be done is to bring the account to bear on legal problems in a constructive way, rather than say people aren't fully rational. What can we do with what we now know? And this is an effort, a little book in the making, I'm going to sketch for you, co-authored with the founder of behavioral economics, who's here at the University of Chicago, and will get a Nobel Prize before long, Richard Thaler. So if there are confusing or erroneous things in the next hour, Thaler does not deserve any time. This is me. Okay, we have three epigraphs for you. The first is from maybe the greatest law review article of all time. First author Guido Calabresi, who's a judge on the Second Circuit. And these are, it's a very famous article, but these words are neglected from the article. A minimum of state intervention is always necessary. When a loss is left where it falls in an automobile accident, it is not because God so ordained it. Rather, it is because the state has granted the injurer an entitlement to be free of liability and will intervene to prevent the victim's friends, if they are stronger, from taking compensation from the injurer. That's Calabresi's claim. The second epigraph is from the President of the United States. You know, I knew that when we laid out the idea of giving seniors choices, it would create a little confusion for some. The reason why we felt it was necessary to provide choices is because we want the system to meet the needs of the consumer. The more choices you have, the more likely it is you'll find a program that suits your specific needs. In other words, one size fits all is not a consumer-friendly program. I did know there would be some worries from having to choose from 40 different plans, but I thought it was worth it. Okay, the second, third and final epigraph, I just read an hour ago. It's from this week's Newsweek, from Jane Bryant Quinn, their economics writer, who is describing changes in laws involving savings plans, and she says, most of the 401k plans today assume that you have the time and interest to train as an investment ace, quick to pick the perfect mix of stocks and bonds. Fat chance, we cross our fingers, make a choice, and never want to look again. Okay, the motivation for these remarks can be captured in two experiments, which now have been carried out a lot. Both are in the domain of savings. The first was a simple switch from the default rule when you start working in American workplaces, where the default rule used to be 0% of your savings go to, your take-home pay goes to savings. All of it goes to take-home pay. And now there are automatic enrollment plans by which, unless you opt out, your money, a certain percentage of your money goes to savings. That's what Jane Bryant Quinn is celebrating, something that will prevent people from being savings-less if they're not investment cases. So automatic enrollment plans are now in place, and they've produced massive increases in savings for low and middle-income Americans who otherwise might have zero savings at time of retirement or in the event of disability. Okay, the second experiment is devised by Thaler, and that is also sweeping the country. It's called the Save More Tomorrow Plan. Under the Save More Tomorrow Plan, what happens is that you agree to devote a certain percentage of your future wage increases to savings. So instead of losing something in current salary, if you get future wage increases, some percentage of it, maybe 2%, 3%, goes into savings. The Save More Tomorrow plan is also, as noted, in place in many American businesses, and savings among low and middle income Americans are leaping as a result. Okay, both of these ideas, the automatic enrollment plan and the Save More Tomorrow plan, are examples of libertarian paternalism, which is the basic idea I'm going to be sketching. They are libertarian in the sense that they don't eliminate freedom of choice. If someone wants to have no savings, they're perfectly permitted to opt out of the Save More Tomorrow plan, of the automatic enrollment plan. And if some people don't want the Save More Tomorrow plan, they needn't get involved. So this is libertarian in the sense that freedom of choice is preserved. It is paternalistic in the sense that the planner, whether it's someone in the private sector or in government, is attempting to steer people's choices in directions which will make their lives go better. So we have self-conscious steering by a planner who believes that one course of action will be better for most people than another. So libertarian paternalists try to move people in directions that do well for them while also preserving freedom of choice. Now, we can have a lot of discussion about what welfare entails. And you could imagine libertarian paternalists who have different conceptions of welfare, more contentious than others. For the moment, let's use the word welfare as uncontroversially as possible to mean lives go better by reference to the considered judgments of the people whose lives are attempting to make go better. So our welfare goal is to make sure that people's lives go better by their own lives, supposing they have information that would support one or another decision. Okay, the argument for libertarian paternalism really just has two props. One is a claim that people's choices don't always make their lives go well, and the other is that paternalism, in one or another sense, is inevitable. So it's directed against two views, which I think are pervasive in law schools and in our culture, where one view is that there's a kind of tautological connection between people's choices and their welfare. That is, the choices just do promote their welfare. And the other is that it is possible for the government to avoid paternalism. So let me say a little bit about those two props. Okay, with respect to the rationality of choices, we now have decades of work suggesting that people's judgments depend on heuristics that can produce errors, that people's judgments are often biased in predictable ways, and their decisions frequently don't promote their welfare. A very important thing to do in life is to take precautions against risks, such as the risks from hurricanes. And we know that whether people will take precautions often depends on whether the event has come to fruition in the recent past. So in the aftermath of a hurricane, precautions and insurance jumps because of the vivid memory. But as the vivid memory recedes, the insurance drops a lot. Now, it's not crazy to make your decisions about precautions depend on whether a recent event has occurred, but it's a heuristic for the statistical probability it can misfire. In the domain of savings behavior, Thaler has conducted a somewhat insidious test of whether people's choices promote their welfare by their own lights. And the insidious test asks a lot of people in California to provide their own savings plan to the experimenters, that is him and his co-author, and to look then in a room at their own savings plan, which they didn't know was what they were looking at, and to compare it against the average and median plans in terms of expected payoffs by people within the relevant population. So people were asked, provide your plan, let's see it, weeks before the experiment. And then they were brought in the room and asked, which of the three plans do you like? Your plan, not knowing it's your plan, the average plan, and the median plan. It turns out that people thought their own plan was about as good as the average plan, and a lot worse than the median plan, in terms of expected payoffs. So people don't like their own savings plans. It's also the case that American workers now, and the Enron disaster brought this home, often have a lot of their money tied up in company stock. Company stock, adjusted for risk, is worth about 50 cents on the dollar. And American workers pervasively believe that it's worth a dollar and more than that. About 500,000 people die as a result of easily preventable risks each year. That's a low estimate, including smoking. The notion that this is a product of optimal decision-making would be hard to sustain. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about paternalism and whether it's avoidable. The simplest claim is that in the private and public sector, our decisions are much affected by default rules, as in the case of the automatic savings plan, which are invisible to us. The fact that there's an allocation by the law or the private sector isn't so clear, but we tend to follow it. A few examples of the importance of default rules. Here's a study I did at this law school a few years ago. It was pretty realistic. About 70 people in the class were asked, suppose you are in a state that has 2 weeks of mandatory vacation time, but you can get two additional weeks if you'll give up a certain amount of your salary, and the negotiation won't hurt you at all with the firm. How much would you give up of your salary, where the starting salary is, let's say, $120,000? How much of it would you give up in order to get the two additional weeks? Another 70 people, the other half of the class, was asked, you're in a jurisdiction where you get 2 weeks of vacation for sure. That's not waivable. You also get two additional weeks of vacation. That's built into state law, but you can give that up for a voluntary knowing waiver, with a voluntary knowing waiver. How much would your firm have to pay you to get you to give up those two additional weeks? Okay? Now, these are, according to the Coase theorem, which some of you have encountered, the rest will encounter, helped win Coase the Nobel Prize. These are, according to the Coase theorem, formally identical questions, unless we do something tricky with them. At first glance, the question is, how much is two additional weeks of vacation time worth to you? And the amount shouldn't depend on what the default rule is. Turns out the amount matters a great deal. When the default rule is you get the two additional weeks, the median dollar amount was more than double the amount people were willing to pay to get the two additional weeks. It varied from $6,000 to $13,000. $13,000 is a little low, actually, because a significant number of University of Chicago law students responded to the question by saying, there's no amount my employer can give me that would make me give up my vacation time. All right. The power of the default rule can be shown in many different ways, not just with respect to vacation time or health care or discrimination policy or savings, but also with respect to policy options that affect people as individuals. Here's one. I don't know how many of you know, I bet not all of you know, what the penalty is for plagiarism at the University of Chicago Law School. It turns out that it's very stiff. What I did at the University of Chicago Law School last year was ask a bunch of students the following. The University of Chicago Law School has a one-quarter suspension policy for a first offense for plagiarism. Some members of the faculty think that's too lenient. Should it be changed to a two-year suspension? The other half of the class was asked, the University of Chicago has a two-year suspension for first case of plagiarism. Should the policy be changed to a one-quarter suspension? All that was changed was the starting point, the status quo, against which the judgment would be made. It turned out that an overwhelming percentage of University of Chicago law students just stuck with the policy that was described as the status quo policy. It had tremendous power. Wondering whether this was a University of Chicago effect, I did exactly the same thing a few weeks ago at Yale, using the University of Chicago in the hypothetical. And they behaved exactly like University of Chicago law students. But essentially, 80% favored the status quo policy. These are experiments, not real-world practices, but I'll give you a real-world example. A few years ago, New Jersey and Pennsylvania, just by fortune and happenstance, had different policies for motor vehicle insurance, where in one of the states, you got, as a default plan, a full right to sue, and you had to pay a fair bit of money for the policy, but you could switch to the less right to sue when you pay less. Whereas in the other state, there was a constricted right to sue, limits on the right to sue, and you paid less, but you could buy the full right to sue for more money. Turned out in Philadelphia and New Jersey, the default policy had tremendous power, that what people did depended on what the default rule was. Okay, these are a bunch of examples, and maybe you can think of illustrations in consumer product safety law, in occupational safety and health law, in policies governing discrimination, where the default rule has tends to be sticky. Why is it so sticky? There seem to be two reasons that help explain it. One is inertia. Whatever the default rule is, people tend to stay with it, even if they could switch it basically just by touching a button. So I'm pretty confident that with respect to most policies that you all and the faculty faces with respect to the university, if they laid them all out in an email and said, push this button if you want to change it, or that button if you want to change it, for most of them, we just stick with the status quo. Okay, so inertia tends to be strikingly powerful, even when the cost of overcoming it is zero. The other thing that seems to be going on is the power of suggestion. That is, when the default rule is specified, most of us seem to think somebody sensible and benign probably selected it, and we ought not to change it unless we have some good reason to think it's a silly default rule that's injuring our interests. So when the people in Philadelphia and New Jersey stuck with the default policy, probably the reason was, this is pretty technical stuff, what's sensible they probably thought through and we should do what they said. So too with the University of Chicago plagiarism rules, where both Chicago students and Yale students evidently thought the status quo policy was probably a product of some thinking, and it ought to stick unless we have overwhelming reasons to think it's not good. Okay, now it might be possible at this point for the most committed libertarians to say, okay, I agree that people's choices sometimes don't promote their welfare. I'm nervous about any effort to constrict choice, not only on the ground that the constriction might not be welfare promoting, but on the ground that people have an interest in choosing for its own sake, independent of welfare. Autonomy may have independent claims. The libertarian might say at this point that so long as whatever you do is choice-preserving, I'm not really distressed yet, but that instead of libertarian paternalism, I want a program of choice by which the default rules aren't imposed on people, even if they can get around them, but in which people are asked freely to choose what to do. Now that's President Bush's basic statement about the prescription drug plan. He's claiming that the multiplicity of choices that the prescription drug plan offers is valuable. And I guess that is an implicit rejoinder to those who would favor a libertarian paternalist response to the prescription drug question. Okay, there are a couple of things to be said about this libertarian rejoinder, which acknowledges the errors to which human beings are prone, but insists on the primacy of choice. Okay, the first thing to do, the first thing to worry about with it is what kind of response is this? Can we describe it? I guess the program it suggests as an alternative to libertarian paternalism is forced choices. Yes? Forced choices or coerced choices, which automatically raises a red flag for those people who in some circumstances have a kind of second order preference, which is not to have to choose. So if you think to yourself, with respect to the vast array of things that the University of Chicago defaults me into, I would not want to have to make a considered judgment about them, because life is short, and these are often things where I don't really know what's best. Then you might think that the program of forced choices isn't in my interest. You might also think that the program of forced choices might lead to results which make people's lives go worse. At least in circumstances in which the question is technical, and some sort of heuristic or bias might lead them astray. Should I have some examples here? And let me give two. Sweden, of all countries, had a social security privatization plan. The poster child of social democracy actually did a very ambitious version of what President Bush was proposing. The social security plan, as it emerged, was choice regulated. It was coerced choices. People really had to choose. There were 450 plans from which the Swedes had to select one. The Swedes were nervous that some people might hate a choice, so they came up with a default plan. This was around 2000. The default plan was carefully selected by technical types. But the Swedes, being anti-paternalistic libertarians, specifically discouraged people from choosing the default plan and asked them to make their own choices, sending around a book which had all the plans and a choice-friendly situation. It turned out that the Swedes, who didn't go with the default plan, put a lot of their money into internet stocks. They lost, on average, 40% of their retirement money. It also that would be predicted, by the way, by the behavioral types, saying the availability heuristic, which looks at recent past, would skew people's judgments if they're not specialists. Internet stocks were exploding before the plan. That was the skew. It also turned out that in the 3 years while the market was collapsing, somewhere between 98 and 99% of Swedes made no change in their plans at all, a prediction which would also follow from the behavioral view which the Newsweek writer captures, which is people make a guess and then stop thinking about it. So inertia is very powerful. I should confess that my retirement money is 50% in TIAA, it's 50% in CREF. I don't know what those words refer to exactly. Except I guess one is stocks and one is just regular, like a bank, something like that. This should be important to me, shouldn't it? And my co-author is probably the most prominent exponent of the view that you really should be putting your money into stocks, not into equities. I still have 50% into bonds. I still have 50% in cash, not in stocks. And it would just take too much time, which is to say 30 seconds, to make a change. The Swedes were like that, too. They stuck with their allocations. And the third thing to say, beyond they're losing 40% of their money, and they've been sticking with their losses, the third thing to say is that the default rule has way outperformed the choices the Swedes actually made. Another illustration that raises a caution about forced choosing is the prescription drug plan itself. Not all the results are in, but we do know two things. First, we know the choice between 30 and 40 plans has confused and distressed large numbers of seniors. And second, significant percentages of seniors, not as high as 50%, but somewhere between 10 and 25%, pretty demonstrably have made decisions that are ill-matched to their own interests. They're buying plans that are cost a fair bit and aren't delivering what they need. Okay, those are cautionary notes about forced choosing, which is not to say that it's always bad, just that it's one tool in the repertoire, and whether it makes sense depends on the circumstance. I'll have more to say that in a bit. Okay, the libertarian paternalist at this stage has a pretty cautious program. The program involves inevitable decisions and about allocations, and is making a reference to bounded rationality, but not really going to town with it. If the libertarian paternalist at this stage wanted to be slightly more ambitious, he or she might think, There's an issue of not only a self-regarding action, but also helping the disadvantaged. What can be done about that? Without much of a change on the claims made thus far, we can quickly see, I think, three illustrations where charitable giving in the United States, broadly understood, could be massively increased without any kind of government program or tax subsidies or moral suasion. Okay, the first is kind of very local, which is organ donations in the U.S. In most states, you must affirmatively indicate that your organs will be available to those who need them, supposing you're essentially dead, and there's an available recipient. About 20% of Americans have affirmatively signaled they want their organs to be donated. In many European countries, there's presumed consent. You are automatically presumed to want to do that, but you can opt out if you don't want to. The default rule here elsewhere is extremely sticky. In European countries, only about 2% of people opt out of the presumed consent. Statistics suggest that if we had a presumed consent rule in the United States, we could save 2,000 or 3,000 lives annually, people who need organs, just as a result of that simple switch in the phone. There's an idea Thaler and I hatched a few years ago, which is that the Save More Tomorrow plan could be supplemented with a Give More Tomorrow plan, in accordance with which, if you want to enter the program, some percentage of your future wage increases could go to charitable giving. I would sign up, though if it took me 30 seconds to do it, I might not. If I were to fall into it, I'd be pretty happy about that. A Give More Tomorrow plan is highly likely, if the Save More Tomorrow plan is any indication, dramatically to increase charitable giving in the U.S. Now there's been some experimental work on the Give More Tomorrow plan, and it suggests it does have a very large increase in charitable giving, and people are voluntarily opting into it. Companies that whose business is charity, and companies that are interested in charities, are just now starting to do this. This could be understood as libertarian benevolence, or it could be understood as a form of libertarian paternalism, if you think part of what many people at least want to do is allocate a certain percentage of their earnings to people who need it, and they don't have the easiest mechanism to do that. That is, to overcome inertia is not always simple. Okay, a third idea, which is automatic enrollment in the savings plan. I'm sorry, the charitable giving plan. You could imagine a workplace which would advertise, if you work here, 1% of your money is going to a charity. You have to designate it, or it's going to be some non-sectarian charity that most people like. If you don't like that charity, you can designate another. If you don't like any charity, you can do that. That automatic enrollment plan, libertarian benevolence, libertarian paternalism, would inevitably knock up savings in the United States. Okay, it may be, I'm curious to hear, that libertarians are okay so far, but the libertarian paternalists have a couple of other things to suggest which will start to make them nervous. They claim, the libertarian paternalists, that the following things, what I'm going to describe, fall within the camp of the libertarian still, but because they're choice preserving. But they're more invasive than what I've described thus far, and some of them have resonances in current law and policy. Okay, the first idea is to say, if the libertarian paternalist has a high degree of confidence that those who opt out of the preferred outcome are making bad decisions, we ought to erect procedural barriers to opt-outs. Suppose the planner has a high degree of confidence that for the vast majority of people, the default situation is really best. Then the libertarian paternalist might say, okay, we're going to impose procedural constraints on opt-out. One example, it's the strongest example of libertarian paternalism may be an anti-discrimination law, which is when you are old and retiring, some companies who want you out are going to give you a good plan, good retirement plan, but they don't want you to sue them under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act. So what they want is a waiver of your right to sue under the Employment Discrimination and Employment Act. Now, we don't generally allow waivers of anti-discrimination rights, a fact that raises problems for all libertarians, including libertarian paternalists. But the Age Discrimination and Employment Act has a qualification, which it says the employee can, at time of retirement, waive any rights under the Age Discrimination and Employment Act in return for something, like a retirement package. But the waiver can't be just writing on paper on the day the plan is offered. There has to be a significant period in which the person can think about it, can consult a lawyer, gets full information, and it has to be a kind of cooling off period so that the waiver is procedurally constrained. You couldn't imagine a libertarian paternalist favoring this for decisions to marry and decisions to divorce, maybe decisions to divorce in particular. And some states do follow this procedural constraint idea, not as a way of foreclosing choice, but a way of ensuring against problems of impulsive or insufficiently reflective behavior. Okay, for the paternalists in the room, the procedural constraints might not seem to be enough in circumstances where you think the person is departing from his or her own self-interest. And there you might impose some sort of substantive constraint beyond the procedural. For example, you might say, if you think that people ought to be wearing their motorcycle helmets, the Ben Roethlisberger accident being a salient example, if you think that most people ought to be wearing motorcycle helmets, but you're sufficiently libertarian not to want the law to require it, you might say you have to wear the motorcycle helmets unless you can demonstrate a safety record for a certain period of years that involves no accidents and no tickets. Or you could say, as current law actually does say, that you can waive your right not to work for more than 40 hours in a week in those sectors of the economy covered by the Fair Labor Standards Act, but only for time and a half. That's a substantive limit, not a procedural limit. It allows people to opt out, but only on kind of plan or specified terms. Whether we're in favor of that or against it, I guess, depends on how confident we are that the planner is right in thinking that the decision to opt out or to go one's own way is erroneous. We distrust planners, and we won't like the substantive limits. The libertarians might say procedural and substantive limits are better, at least, than coercion in the form of non-libertarian. There's only one other thing the libertarian paternalist has to propose, and then we'll get to some qualifications. And what the only other thing the libertarian paternalist has to propose is information campaigns that are behaviorally informed. So the libertarian paternalist says that it's become standard to say that when people are making inadequately informed decisions, they should be given information, especially when they're facing risks that maybe they don't adequately appreciate. What the libertarian paternalist says is the notion of providing more information is kind of obtuse because everything depends on how the information is framed. Good framing of information can move behavior a lot more than bad framing of information. If a doctor tells you when you're about to have an operation, 100 people have this operation, 10 are getting sick, 5 years later, you're much likely less likely to have the operation than if the doctor says if 100 people have this operation, 90 are quite well 5 years later. The framing of it in terms of good versus bad has a big impact. Here's an example of something libertarian paternalists might be drawn to on the information side. A lot of people in the U.S. could benefit economically from using energy conservation techniques in their home. They don't, even though it's in their economic interest, and it's probably in the interest of national security as well as environmental protection to do that. If you tell people, if you use energy conservation techniques, you'll save the following amount of money every year, you get much less of a reaction than if you tell people, if you don't use energy conservation techniques, you'll lose a certain amount of money every year. People are loss averse. They hate losses from a status quo. And how the situation is described can push behavior in one or another direction. So an information campaign that puts the spotlight on losses has a much greater impact than one that puts the spotlight on gains. Another example has to do with risk-creating behavior such as smoking, which results in some people from optimistic bias. Many smokers believe that they have a good appreciation of the statistical risks of smoking, but they also believe that they themselves are less likely to get cancer or heart disease than the average non-smoker. Kind of amazing data, where the smokers have the statistical reality right, but they are pervasively optimistic about their own prospects, believing that they are immune from the risks that other smokers face, in fact, less at risk than non-smokers. Okay, one way to respond to that is to use the availability heuristic by telling people, smokers that is, of the lived reality of heart disease or lung cancer. If they're informed in vivid terms about what it's like, in a way that's not misleading, but accurate, but vivid, then you get a much bigger behavioral effect than if you tell people statistical realities. And libertarian paternalists are fine with this because you're not pushing people in any, you're not forcing people to do what the government doesn't want them to do. Okay, just I guess a couple of additional notations. Two obvious questions that the libertarian paternalist faces have to do with how much choice should be offered. Let's stick with that one for the moment, not because I forgot the other one. How much should one offer? Lots of choices, as in the Swedish Social Security plan, or fewer? What kind of menu of options should the libertarian paternalist favor? Okay, offhand, the libertarian paternalist is interested in three questions. First, are people's preferences informed? Second, is there a lot of heterogeneity in the relevant population? And third, do people consider choice itself an intrinsic good? In circumstances in which there's not much diversity in the relevant population, people's preferences aren't terribly informed, and people don't care much about choice, then the need for 450 plans isn't so strong. In a case where there's a lot of diversity, this is President Bush's plea with respect to retirement plans, a lot of heterogeneity, people either do or can be made to have informed preferences, and where they value choice as an end in itself, then this is what you want to do. That is, provide a lot. Okay, the question which I forgot, I now remember, which is, how does one decide, if one is a libertarian paternalist, where to set the default rule, or what the starting point ought to be? Okay, from the arguments thus far, it should be a welfare inquiry. If we have a lot of confidence that Americans are saving too little for retirement, or that Americans would be better off if charitable giving were increased on net, then the welfare inquiry would tell us what the default rule should be. If we don't have a lot of confidence in that, then we have three things we might think about, three ways to decide what the starting point should be. One is, what would most people choose? This is kind of a familiar idea from contract law, where you're trying to figure out the market mimicking solution. It may be that sometimes what people choose is a product of the default rule. True. But you can imagine some allocations, such as 80% of people's salary goes to savings, which would be so far afield from what people would choose that that's off limits. So sometimes you can think what people would choose in a way that will tell us what to do. Okay. Sometimes you might be able to resolve the question, if that's too hard, by forcing choices. And here the libertarian paternalist will acknowledge that coerced choices are sometimes the best route. Libertarian paternalists, finally, will sometimes say the best thing to do is to figure out which approach people opt out from least. So if it's the case that people opt out a lot from automatic enrollment in X or Y or Z, then we should be nervous about having that on the default rule. If they opt out a little from automatic enrollment, then we have reason to think that that's a good idea. Okay, I'm going to conclude by talking about counter arguments. And then the two that seem to me tempting and weak, and two that seem to me strong and to need a lot more thinking. Okay, the first tempting argument says that there's a terrible slippery slope problem. That once we acknowledge the legitimacy of libertarian paternalism, then ambitious and choice-denying options will be with us in short order. And some economists who are nervous about libertarian paternalism have been pressing this argument. I hope I've said enough to suggest why the slippery slope argument is weak. It disregards the fact that some sort of starting point is inevitable and it will affect people's choices. So there's no avoiding that start on the slippery slope. Try. The second response is that the slippery slope, if it's a concern about choice-denying options, is taken care of by the libertarian insistence on the preservation of choice. So if one is nervous about Hillary Clinton's health care plan from a few years back, that's ruled off limits for the libertarian paternalist by virtue of its coercive quality. A second tempting objection has to do with planner bias or confusion. You might think that the planners who are setting up the default rules or engaging in the advertising campaign are unreliable because their self-interest is at stake. Okay, insofar as the libertarian paternalist is insisting on the inevitability of certain routes, that's not a good objection, is it? Because the planner is going to be doing something. There's no avoiding the risk of planner bias or confusion, because the planner has to set out starting points. Okay, here are two, seems to me, more interesting objections to libertarian paternalism. I'm not sure what to do with them. I'd be curious, any reactions by email or otherwise. The first objection goes, there are some aspects of the program that look manipulative and potentially deceptive. The advertising campaigns maybe are the clearest example, where if the behaviorally informed planner is enlisting loss aversion or the availability heuristic in the interest of what is sought, then it's a little like maybe subliminal advertising, where people are being pushed or tricked into outcomes that the planner thinks in their interest. And you could imagine a company whose business it is to increase savings, not because they're benevolent, but because they want a lot of money from which they can benefit by skimming some off the top. You could imagine such a company armed with behavioral findings, figuring out how to default people into very high savings rates that serve the interests of the planner and not the saver. The behavioralist thinks it's kind of child's play to be able to play with this stuff to manipulate people in directions that are serving the interests of the planet. Okay, the concern here is the insult to people's autonomy that's reflected in these tricks. Okay, I think the best way to handle this objection is suggested by the philosopher John Rawls in his kind of suggestive writing on the publicity principle. He says that a policy isn't acceptable if it could not be defended publicly to those on whom it's imposed. So the idea would be it's an insult to people's dignity to force them to live with a policy which they could not be made to see and approve of. And this maybe would cut across many apparently public spirited government interventions. Now, on Rawls's view, the publicity principle has to do with respect and dignity. If you're not a Rawlsian type, you might give it a more utilitarian or welfarist feel, saying that if the government is doing this sort of manipulation, it's likely not to work. Once people are told about what it's done, people are outraged. Upset. Okay, this does put, the publicity principle does put a constraint on the uses of libertarian paternalism. But I hope the examples I've given, having to do with savings and charity and discrimination and product safety, don't run afoul of the simplicity principle. Okay, the last objection comes from great conservative thinker Burke. And here's Burke's thought. Burke hated social engineers and loved traditions. So the Burkean objection to the libertarian paternalist would say, you are really a social engineer in the grip of some kind of theory about what makes people's lives go well. And you're using the theory as a basis for eroding either public or private practices that have built up, been built up by many people over time. So the good Burkean, I think, the sensible Burkean, says it's not as if there's a world without default rules that are publicly or privately created. There isn't. We acknowledge the inevitability of that, the Burkean said. But the default rules that are in place have a kind of rationality and wisdom that particular planners aren't going to be able to see or capture, and which they'll override, like the French in their revolution overrid French traditions. Okay, this is undoubtedly sometimes a good objection. And if it's the case that the traditions that the libertarian paternalist is bucking, that those traditions do have wisdom and reflection and contributions in them, then the libertarian paternalist should hesitate. I think the best thing for the libertarian paternalist to say about this is too often the practices that the Burkean wants to celebrate really are themselves a reflection of bounded rationality and purely imitative behavior. So in domains like discrimination and savings and charitable giving, it's not as if existing practices reflect the wisdom of long-standing actors. Instead, it's the case that there's coincidence and randomness and worse behind these practices. What Hamilton, in this very un-Burkean moment in The Federalist Number 1, called accident and force, saying it's up to Americans to decide whether constitutions can be produced by reflection and choice rather than accidents and force. That's, I think, the core of the libertarian paternalist response to the Burkean, though it's a partial response. It depends on the particular thing that the libertarian paternalist wants to intervene in. Okay, it's time to conclude. I guess the structure of the argument is clear, that the libertarian paternalist wants to preserve choice while also pushing people's decisions in directions that will make their lives go better. The libertarian paternalist hopes that the program can get us beyond the stale and increasingly tired debate between Republicans who want laissez-faire and Democrats who want governmental mandates and demands. The claim would be that the Republicans are right to be nervous about ill-made, motivated, or confused planners, and the Democrats are also right to be nervous about the possibility that individual choices will make people's lives go poorly, at least some of the time. The libertarian paternalists will like the end of the paper from a little essay in Newsweek, which in describing a law in August of this year, just a little over a month ago, the Pension Protection Act, which Congress took a strong and kind of amazing first step in the direction of libertarian paternalism, trying to preserve and protect pensions by encouraging automatic enrollment plans and Save More Tomorrow, from the pages of academic articles to the pages of the United States Code in an amazingly short time. The libertarian paternalist will say that the Newsweek article had it right in both approving of this law and asking in its closing paragraph, is this paternalistic? You bet. And the libertarian paternalist will say that this basic orientation has the promise for orienting law in multiple domains, going well beyond savings. Done. Comments, questions, concerns?
Improvements in systematic irrationality or in context, so like we
could. The first thing to say is the behavioral types don't use the word irrationality because it suggests kind of craziness. What's preferred is the word bounded rationality because the heuristics that people use to assess risk by asking, as an example, occurred in the recent past. Okay. Such evidence there is suggests that even in iterated experiments, people continue basically to rely on their heuristics. They don't, there's experimental settings in their real world. In contexts in which people show deep departures from economic conception of rationality, if you think of any papers, I'm sure there are some, where people return to the right way of thinking as they play again and again and again. We could devise an experiment where that would surely happen. And it would be one where people are prone, let's say, to heuristics, which, as the experiment is designed, gets them into immediate and highly visible trouble. They keep seeing their payoffs aren't good. Then you'd expect a correction. And I don't know of any paper like that, but I'm sure it would be possible to devise one. In the clearest example is a paper that Thaler's a co-author of on the endowment effect, where there are lots and lots of rounds. The endowment effect is shorthand for people like goods if they get them, if they own them, more than they will demand more to give up the good that they own than they'll be willing to pay for the same good if they don't have it, which shouldn't be. If you all are given chocolate bars and ask how much would you be willing to pay to give up the chocolate bars, the amount's just going to be higher than if you all aren't given chocolate bars and you're asked how much would you be willing to pay to get the chocolate bars. And this isn't because you all like chocolate bars more than you all like chocolate bars. It's that the initial allocation has a big effect. Now I can see from looking at you that you're all thinking of a bunch of explanations about why this might be so. And all of them, or at least most of the ones you're thinking about, have some validity. But they don't exhaust the phenomenon. And what Thaler and Kahneman showed is that after repeated games, people don't do this. They don't stop doing this. They don't return to economic conceptions of rationality. So we could go on and say, in ordinary life, when we blunder, we learn and do better. And surely that's true. So then the libertarian paternalist, I think, would say, in cases in which people have repeated, and it's a great question, if people have repeated engagements with some choice, and they get transparent information about whether they've made the right choice, then there wouldn't be any problem to correct probably. But that's why the domain of the libertarian paternalist tends to be choices we don't make often. We don't very easily see any feedback. So in cases where there's a cooling off period, like encyclopedia sales or divorce, these repeat things. And so too with savings decisions and decisions involving waivers of your right to be free from age discrimination. I think what I'm not sure of is there are some domains, including where people make a lot of choices. It's visible what's happening. And still they do really badly. And why is that? I don't know if it's because of optimistic bias or rationalization or something. But you're absolutely right that in circumstances where people make lots of choices and get very visible feedback, then the planner needs probably be worrisome.
Just, an institutional, maybe a public policy question. If you have libertarian paternalism, where do you implement that? Would it be safe to allow, say, individual companies to determine the default plan, or is it even safe for states? Or would it be up to the federal government, or what's the optimal way?
Okay. All right. Insofar as we're talking about inevitable paternalism, then somebody's doing it. Even if they're not aware of it. So if the national government, under some law, has as the default rule that 0% of take-home pay goes to
savings or to health care. That's the policy. That's the default rule. It might be a good one, but it's a default rule. So to some extent, it's unavoidable. And okay, some forms of it, like the substantive constraints and the procedural constraints and the informational, those are avoidable. And I guess at a rough first cut, you'd be happiest allowing private companies to do it. And the reason is there's market discipline on self-serving or confused libertarian paternalism. So if some company starts making people, let's say, where making is too simple, give lots and lots of their money to charities, and after years they learn they're poor, that company's not going to be able to attract so many workers next time. So we like the private sector best. The states, for Brandeis's reason, we like second best, because there are experiments. We learn something and we can minimize the damage. We like the federal government doing at least. But if the problem is serious enough, and there are democratic checks on what the national government does, I wouldn't want to have a ban on advertising campaigns. But maybe we want to reserve it for cases like smoking and drug and alcohol abuse, where the risks are most demonstrable.
A good starting point would be that we're not living in a pure democracy anyway. It's a Republican system. And my understanding is the reason for that is because you don't want citizens to be making choices on each and every issue. You want to have them make the initial choice on the representative, and then they make the subsequent choices. And that's a traditional understanding. And if that's true, then doesn't libertarian paternalism make sense in that it only needs to offer an individual choice, the only real choice that the citizens have to make is who that representative will be who are making the choice. And the only reason libertarian paternalism exists is to give them that comfort of having a real choice in the areas where they really need a real choice.
Okay, it's an excellent question. I don't know if everyone heard it. The claim was that we live in a republic, not a democracy, in the sense that our representatives aren't supposed to take snapshots of majority will and implement it. They're supposed to engage in deliberation. The reason this is a proposal, libertarian paternalism, and not just a description of what people are committed to, is that many, want to know who's against the libertarian paternalism, the libertarian paternalists. Many libertarians would say, we do have a republic, and one of the beautiful things in our republic is that we have a system of checks and balances against paternalistic interventions in the domain of free choice. So the idea would be that our republic is, at least at the national level, has safeguards against the paternalist program, to which the libertarian paternalist says there's a possibility you've omitted, and indeed there's inevitability to what scares you. That's why I started out, I fear the quotation from Calabresi is obscure, but what Calabresi is saying is when losses fall one way or another, it's not because God ordained it, it's there's an allocation of entitlements there. And that's the libertarian paternalist claim about inevitability. So I guess I'm saying that the fact that we have a republic and not a democracy leaves open the question whether we should be anti-libertarian paternalists, the Democratic Party in 1970, we should be anti-paternalist libertarians, maybe often the Republican Party in the last 20 years, or we should be the third thing. So what I think is really good in your question is that there's something kind of paternalistic in the very notion of a republic, which is it recognizes lack of information and maybe also, well, Madison certainly bounded rationality on the part of citizens. So the choice for a republic was that citizens wouldn't know enough, and also they'd get all upset and be impulsive and push things that weren't in their own interests. So Madison talks about a rage for paper money. That turned out not to be so so terrible, but or the abolition, the abolition of debts, that can be bad, the abolition of debts, if the economy doesn't go, and other projects of the people. He wants to protect against that. And yes, a kind of, I think, a cheap victory for the paternalists against the libertarians is to say, you're so nervous about bounded rationality and passion at the government level. Why aren't you nervous about this at the individual level? So why are libertarians so worst-casing government and best-casing individuals? But I think libertarians have a response to that, signaled by this question, which is that markets have a kind of built-in discipline and protection, which, and if you put that together with the earlier point about iterated behavior, where you know every time you bet on the Chicago Cubs to win the World Series, be optimistic, and then you can see you're losing, and then you're going to bet on the Yankees.
As you discuss the debate between proponents and critics of libertarian paternalism, stress values, social desires, whether shelter or autonomy, that kind of relates to the individual.
Well, since this is going to be the last question, you can relax.
And I was wondering if the libertarian paternalist framework that I was going to for.
Either that the reason for it is to put people in a position to be able to choose well, or to help third parties or to overcome third collective action problems, or to produce nice network effects, then I think the libertarian paternalist has nothing to say, except that those more aggressive forms of intervention may or may not be justified depending on their consequences. Okay, but you're asking if there's an intrusion on autonomy in the sense that people have to do this stuff, even though there might be a promotion of welfare. The libertarian paternalist doesn't have, I think, anything to say about that. And I can tell you what I would say about that, which is we want to know about, if the autonomy is that of children, then we worry less than it's that of adults. If it's adults, it would be happiest and nicest if we could be confident that they're, that it's like a solution to a prisoner's dilemma, so that they're being forced to do something, but it's in their interest, and they can see that, which would be true if there's a network effect. So I guess at first glance, you don't want to intrude on people's freedom of choice in the unless it's clearly in their interest and they can be made to see that. Now, if they can't easily be made to see that, then the burden is heavy on the planner who wants to force them.
Thank you very much.